Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome, everybody. So glad you could join us tonight. This is the fourth of a series of seven shows that we are doing with Gary Wayne. Just a little bit about the book, as Amazon writes it, as was graphically described in the first Genesis 6 conspiracy book, there are giants among us, passing largely unnoticed, intent on carrying out a secret plan to enslave all humanity. They may not look like giants today, but their bloodlines and DNA extend all the way back to the Nephilim, the offspring of angels who mated with human women, described in Genesis 6 when giants were roaming the land. Now in this new book, Gary goes in-depth with new information and explanations for each premise laid out in the first book. By adding the fact-filled book to your understanding, you'll be able to clearly understand and articulate how we are living in the end of times. The book was written to help answer the lingering questions many Christians have and to provide scripturally researched answers and data points for those questions. Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 2 explores Scripture's accounting of prehistory, history, and its important prophetic connections, and explains in layman's terms how it fits together in deciphering the end of times. I've read the first book three times, and this is my first time through this book, so I don't have a full grasp of everything because I'm reading it section by section as we go along, but it does explain a lot. It opens your eyes a lot, and it makes you question a lot. So without further notice, I'm going to pull Gary on to answer all my questions. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Well, thank you for inviting me back, and so happy to be here, and so happy to answer any questions, whether or not the audience sends in questions or not, or they send in questions for the next show. But this is all about providing information and providing things that maybe people haven't thought about before to sort of better understand the world we live in, because what we have today is built on the millennia of things that came before us. And so it's important to understand how we get from point A to point B, let alone to where we're going. And I think the Bible has just so much knowledge in it about those early periods of prehistory and into early history that it's not properly explored in my sort of perspective, and it's not taught a lot in churches, let alone prophecy. And so you have most of the Bible that's based in ancient history and prophecy, and it's rarely taught to provide the context for all of the terrific values and principles and do's and don'ts that are in the Bible.
Well, and I think the first thing that actually it just hit me today was that the Bible is sort of focused geographically on a specific area on the planet, and yet did the fallen angels only fall on that part of the world, or was the entire world engulfed with fallen angels and aboriginals? And, you know, was this, because it just feels like the only part of our history that we have any knowledge of is that one geographic region that the Bible speaks of. But, I mean, there was a whole world out here. Did they fall all over or just in that one place?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's a different way to the answer before the flood and after the flood, but it arrives at the same destination. So in Genesis 6, or Genesis 1, and it's talking about day 6 in the creation of male and female in plural and in multiples and told to replenish the earth. And as they migrated into those areas before the flood, the angels were already in control. And they were already in charge of the world, just as Satan is the prince of this world today. He was the prince of the world back then. And so the rebellion would have predated the creation of original people of day 6. And so the giants aren't created until Genesis 6. So, you know, over 1,000 years after the creation of the people of day 6, if you go with standard chronology, I might suggest that that's a little bit longer in terms of reading the Bible in a way that doesn't present any sort of conflict. So I look at creation of Adam as being sometime later, and so that time frame fits with the genealogy for Adam, but not with the people of day 6. And again, for people who want to get a hold of me, why I think there's two different creations, I won't go into a long spiel about it today, but just understand that there's too many conflicts, and I don't believe the Bible is in conflict. And Adam's details in creation, as well as Eve, and this narrative is at odds with the day 6 narrative. So you have people that are populated around the earth by the time Cain is ostracized. And when he goes to Nod, he's going to run into some of these people, and they're already worshiping the pantheon of gods. So that has happened as the people had spread out with the creation. So whether or not they started at an epicenter or God put them everywhere at the same time, we're not clearly told that. But with the flood, you have only the 8 on the ark from the biblical perspective who survive. And I think there's a second incursion for giants, but I'm still open to the ideas we've talked about in past shows that some of them have survived. And so the recreation of the giants are done after the flood, before Babel, and are done by the offspring gods who replaced the parent gods who ruled before the flood and are in the pit prison. And so there's over 100 years before Babel begins to be built. And there's an incident, as we talked about in the last show with Ham, that there's a curse on Canaan. And after Babel, they're going to move into the covenant land where some of the giants are. But there's giants that are created in this incursion that have either migrated out from the first incursion site, or there was multiple sites in the first 100 years. And then after Babel, you have people migrating into these lands that are already populated by giants. And it's these giants and the Olam and Elam, as we talked about in the last show, which means, you know, the ancient from the east. These are the aboriginals, and all the giants after the flood are described in their definitions coming out of Hebrew as aboriginals. So the people moving in from Babel, you know, are more recent, but it's only from a second incursion perspective, maybe aboriginals could be 100 years, right? So, and a little more, depending on how long it took people to migrate around the world. But they're all worshiping the various pantheons of gods. And one suspects there are other creations of giants other than, you know, just as second incursion, I think, as I talked about in previous shows, was done at Sodom, after the flood. One presumes, though, that there was other incursions elsewhere around. And we talked about Gilgamesh as being a different kind of giant in Mesopotamia from the giants of the East versus the red-haired, blonde-haired, hazel-eyed, and blue-eyed giants that are typically associated with the Tuatha De Danann, Indo-Aryan, Scythians, and giants in the Land of the Covenant, versus the dark-haired ones that Gilgamesh, Nimrod, is associated with, other giants from Mesopotamia, Syria kings, Anatolian kings, Asia Minor, into islands like Crete and into the southern parts of Greece. And so there seems to have been several kinds of races from different watchers that were created.
Now, that brings me to another question I have. I'm right with you all along, and suddenly I'm seeing mention of the elvens and the fairies and those of dragon blood. Now, you go right over into fiction here. You know, all the names are, I won't even try pronouncing them. And then suddenly, you know, they're the elvens and the fairies. And, I mean, why, first of all, elven and fairies? I mean, those are current definitions of a specific breed of fictional or not, you know, beings. How do they suddenly turn up with the giants?
Yeah, so it starts with, from a biblical perspective, it starts with the hybrid races that we talked about in the last show. So you have the Dukes of Seir, which are in Genesis 36. And this is an addition to the Table of Nations, where you have all of the patriarchs that are listed from the descendants of Noah and nations named eponymously after those patriarchs, except for those hybrids that we talked about that were nine of the Canaanite tribes out of the 12, with Canaan being, you know, descendant, you know, son of Sam, son of Noah, and Heth and Sidon are sons of Canaan. And only three of the 12 Canaanite tribes or families have been listed. And we talked about the word family that the Amorites and the Jebusites, these are all a different kind of being. These are hybrid giants. These people were created through the intermarriage of females from Canaan, Seth, and Sidon to create these hybrids with Rephaim, or second incursion giants. And that's why the patriarch isn't listed. And so in Genesis 36, where we have an addendum on it, we have information that's important to understanding the lineage of Esau, brother of Jacob, who lost all of his birthright, his inheritance, and the Messianic blessing to Jacob, who was the younger son. And so in Genesis 36, Esau marries into a Horim, one of the giants of the covenant land, female named Oholibama. I butchered that name, but it's it's not quite coming to me in my head right now, the full letters of it. And anyways, it's listed in there, and she is the daughter of Anna, the daughter of Seir, which is the Duke Seir, which is kind of the one who moved this part of the Horim branch to the Seir region, and the mountain is named after Seir, and Seir goes back to Hebrew as a fat tear, and so he was a hairy Horim and a cave dweller in the Mount Seir area. And so we have a hybrid human race that is being started with Esau, and you also have Amalek being born from Eliphaz, son of Esau, who marries Timnah, a direct daughter of Seir. And the Horim kings and the patriarchs coming out of Esau are all called dukes. And it's that word duke that goes back to Hebrew as the word Aleph. And you get another variation of that coming out of Eliphaz's name too. But you get this understanding that these are Aleph kings, as you would understand it. And as the Catholic Bible phrases it, the Alephim. So these aren't fictional accounts. And this is and Amalek will be part of the 12 tribes of Edom that are going to be intermarrying with the Kassites and the Mitanni of the northern covenant land region to Mount Hermon and a little bit to the east. And they're intermarrying into purebred giant tribes that are also dwelling there. And these become transliterated as the Elven kings, the Elven branch line, and the Elf as in ELF as opposed to ALF, and the fairy kings. And this is the allegory for the matriarchal bloodlines after the flood to start new dynasties. And so bloodlines that go back to female giants is the Elven, fairy, or owl bloodline. And for the patriarch, it is dragon, raven, for the male bloodline. So this is part of the whole understanding and history of particularly giants that will later migrate to Europe after they're being pushed out of the Middle East, and they're going to start the royal families, the kings of God, royal, El being a transliteration, free El for an angel or a god, and Roy meaning king or ruler, as it comes out of Indo-Aryan and Latin and Old French. And so they are going to adopt these words as Duke and Elven as part of their understanding of their bloodlines and their genealogies. And it's going to turn into names that are used for a Gnostic religion and groups of Gnostic religions that are active in the time of the Templars and the Middle Ages that lived amongst the Templars and were part of that Gnostic movement. And these are not just the Cathars, but also their sister religion, the Albigensian. And is basically a transliteration as fairy and elf, and Gensian is that bloodline, as in Albigens, and back to a specific patriarch and a matriarch, as you would take that back on both sides of the genealogy. So a lot of these terms that come down through history that shows up in fairy tales and interesting sort of writings is that concept that, you know, Lewis and Tolkien took to kind of a craft level of mythopoetic, and where they tell very, very good stories, great, excellent narratives and tales, and they use information from prehistory, they use information from the polytheist religion and characters out of prehistory, particularly bloodline characters, and encode it with a lot of allegory. So you get a terrific superficial story in the fairy tale, and underneath you have to be adept to understand all of the meanings that are laid into it. So, you know, an older version of this might be the King Arthur and the Grail tales sponsored by the Templars to write, where you have Uther Pendragon in the King Arthur tales as the father of Arthur and a Tuatha De Áin fairy folk descendant. And Guinevere is a fairy queen, also of Tuatha De Áin lineage. And this is sort of standard sort of understanding is how they keep their culture alive in plain sight. And we've had this all throughout our history with this type of writings because they controlled the top two classes, as we've talked about. So if we understand that things that are written in quote-unquote fairy tales actually have a historical representation and understanding, and we separate the fact that the fairy tale is just for entertainment, but the things that are also in there reflect their history, then we start to have a better understanding that we shouldn't take anything for granted that we see coming out of our literature or entertainment, because it's there to keep the bloodline history alive.
The other thing that there was I forget exactly how it was, but I suddenly stepped back and I said, wait a minute, they're talking about a circle of rings or a grouping of ring giants, or, you know, and that, of course, again, goes back to Tolkien.
Yeah, who was the other great author of that mythopoetic style that is that we come to know it as. And he wrote fiction based on Tuatha De Danann history from a Norse perspective versus a Celtic perspective of Britain and Ireland. And so more blonde-haired varieties of giants in his writing. And this Lord of the Rings is that rings of kings that were at Nippur, the Anunnaki, the Shining Ones, who were the tribe of Danu. The Datanu, as we talked about, of the assembly of giants at Mount Hermon, or Mount Saffon, as it's recorded in the Ugaritic texts. So again, he is writing about history, and all of these types of creatures are in there are from their history. So you have like gnomes, which are the ones who looked after the genealogies. Well, the ones that people would probably recognize out of Tolkien would be more like the hobbits or the dwarves. And the dwarves are shown in Lord of the Rings where they're in the mountains in the earth, and their role was to make the weapons for the demigods. Not for the gods, as it said, but for the demigods. And every little elemental had a specific role and within the whole giant hegemony, both before and after the flood. And the noble elf that's in there is a fair folk. A fairy folk, and that they would be normally considered as larger. These are white elves versus the dark elves. The dark elves are the small ones. The white elves are the large ones, and these are the Sidhe, the She, the Sea. They're pronounced a whole bunch of different ways, and the Tuatha De Dananas are also understood as giants, both before and after the flood. And all of these beings that are being allegorized in Lord of the Rings, you see them at the end of the trilogy on a boat sailing away, because now is the time of man. And that is an allegory for after the flood, these beings are going to be more hidden and not as visible, where they're completely active according to polytheist history before the flood. And that only man will be there, and of course, as it turns out, the giants are there after the flood as well. So when we look at that type of writing, we need to understand that they had intimate knowledge of this, because they were part, Tolkien and Lewis had royal bloodlines, and they were initiated as part of being the bloodlines from childhood. So when they went to a Rosicrucian society, the Rosicrucian had three different levels of the society, and one of those, of the lower levels, was the Golden Dawn organization. They sponsored the Inkling Society at Oxford. And of course, if you're going to Oxford in the 1920s and 30s, you are not your average middle class or poor person. You're part of the nobility elite. So I have some documents on Tolkien and Lewis, the six-part series, if they want to get a hold of me. And I dig deep into their writings. And then parts five and six, I give each of their family genealogies that takes them back to the royales. And so this Inkling Society is part of a secret society of writers. And they're not there to learn about the history. They're learned to perfect their storytelling craft. So you might take that back into history for things like in the time of King James, and just before, in the time of Queen Elizabeth, when a fellow by the name of Francis Bacon creates two writing societies to create the New English that is going to be used in the imagined new empire of England that is going to try and dominate the world. And, you know, eventually we get the empire where the sun never sets in the manifestation of that Templar dream and that Rosicrucian dream. And he was a Rosicrucian. And the names of those two societies, one is the Knights of the Helmet, and the other one is the Spearshaker Society. And the Spearshaker was Athena and Apollo, who held this weapon of the gods, which is higher than the demigods, the giants, and it was a very powerful weapon, and they would shake that spear. Now, if that sounds kind of familiar for somebody who grew up at that time and became famous as a writer and was part of the Spearshaker Society, you might suspect that there's something going on there between William Shakespeare, Bacon, and the Spearshaker Society. But those were the gods that were in charge of the arts. And this is a style that goes back into history. So when we get a lot of the mythology that's written down by the great writers, whether it's Ovides or Hesiod or others, it's a mix of history and mythology, but within the characters and within the meanings of the stories is the true history that the adepts could understand. And this is that style of fairy tale that comes forward out of prehistory. And it's used, again, to hide their history in plain sight, because the polytheist religions is a knowledge religion, and you have to learn and be an adept to understand the meanings to the allegories and the characters that are written in this type of literature.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and read everything all over again because, you know, I've of course done the Lord of the Rings and the other stuff too, but not looked upon it that way. And the Tuatha De Danann, I mean, I just recently, within the last couple of years, discovered them, and you know, they predate the Druids, so you know, they do go way back. And a whole other aspect here. Every time I think I have a handle on things, I find there's no handle at all. So I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful for you and your education.
And there's just so much information to sort of have to go through. So I try and condense it and put it in. And so, when you go back now with that, if you were to look at certain aspects of book one, you're going to see a lot of Tuatha De Danann information in there that runs through this book, but not to the same sort of detail. But I wanted to make that sort of connection back. And then so in this book, I'll have annotations or footnotes where I'll cite where it comes from the book, or from the genealogical perspective, I like to use Lawrence Gardner, who is a well-known genealogist of the Royals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he actually wrote a book on the Shining Ones, I think.
He wrote several books.
he wrote lots of them. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. I think I have most of them, too. Just fabulous information that he has in it. And at first you're saying, well, is this real or isn't it real? And then you start to dig into the history and you're going, you know, he's not that far off. It has a different biases to it, as the polytheist biases versus my monotheist biases. But he's talking about the same events and the same peoples. And so it's a matter of understanding it from both sides of the fence.
Absolutely. And, you know, to get back to tonight's topic, I you know, thank you for enlightening me. Because I was thinking, you know, I at one point it was like, is it a Bible or is it a fairy story? And, you know, it's both.
Yeah, because in a lot of aspects, polytheism drafts important pieces out of the Bible and into their what they would call their more globalist understanding. And so a lot of the terms that Gardner uses in history, he pulls out of the Bible as well. But again, with with the polytheist sort of intention and biases. And all I try and do is I try and note those connections and then try and understand why. So once you know that you have something special going on in Genesis 36, that's very important to worldwide understanding, it really starts to open the eyes. And again, you start to understand how this world was put together early on and the organizational structure of government and society that stemmed from that, and that such a select few was able to hold on to power for such a long period of time. And one would argue that they still have that power today. It's because they were here before the people of Babel migrated, and before the flood. I mean, they just used their pure power to overcome the governments, and thus came the flood. But it just starts to give you a better understanding.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's I've often wondered, you know, when Moses sent the scouts into Canaan, and they came back and they said that they were giants and they looked upon us like grasshoppers and stuff like that. I've always thought, okay, so it's one tribe. What's the big deal? Now I'm beginning to realize that it wasn't one tribe, it was a whole nation they were coming up against.
There were multiple nations of hybrids. Multiple nations of hybrids and giants. And so what we get listed in Numbers 13:33, where you're and the scouting report that was before the embellished part of the report, is the Anakim that are talked about and people that are taller. They're talking about two different peoples there. And the Anakim were said to be giants in Numbers 13:33, which goes back to the Hebrew word Nephilim. But they weren't Nephilim, they were Rephaim. And in Deuteronomy 2, Anakim are said to be giants, but it goes back to the Hebrew word Rapha. And then in Deuteronomy 2 is I pull a segment out of that to lead into the section, what I call the post-diluvian Rephaim world order in section 4. And other names in there are like Horim, that are giants, and Avim that are giants, and Emims and Zamzuzim that are giants. And that's not all of them. These ones are just ones that are listed there in the lands that Israel was about to march up on the east side of the Jordan River through Moab and Edom, and then Moab and Ammon, and then up to Mount Hermon, where Sihon and Og were reigning. And so Anakim is just a group of many giant nations that Section 4 will cover, and that they were not Nephilim. But what that statement says in the evil part of the report, or the embellished part of the report, is that the Israelites understood how big the giants were before the flood. And I'm not saying Anakim weren't giants, and I'm not saying the Amorites were not giant, or the Amalekites, because they were. They were just the hybrids. They were 7 to 9 feet tall versus somewhere between 10 and, let's say, 15 or 16 feet tall. And there's ones that were in Mesopotamia, like Gilgamesh, that was 19 feet tall. So they were still giants and more than twice the size of humans. And then there was the hybrids. And so the Anakim that were listed in that report were Sheshai, Talmai, and Ahiman. And they were kings of Arba, or Kiriath Arba, the city of Arba that we know as Hebron. And Arba was the patriarch for the Anakim, as they're listed, as he's listed in the book of Joshua as the patriarch and the greatest of the Anakim. But Arba is not in the Table of Nations, because Rephaim aren't in the Table of Nations, just as Rapha is not listed there. So when we're looking at these giants, they were literally giants, and there's many, many more that most people don't identify as giants in the Old Testament. So one of the ways that that you are going to look to identify giant names or hybrids is do they have a patriarch in the Table of Nations? And if they don't, that's a key indication that they might be a giant nation. And so,
when,
with the, with, and going back to the Amalekites, they're named after a giant tribe that they're going to go live amongst. The Amalekim giants, the actual giants, are there are around over 200 years before, and they're in the giant, the War of Giants in Genesis 14. So they predate the Amalekites and the hybrids that would have been seen in the land of the Southern Covenant, or as the wording is put there, it's so closely associated with the giants, with the Anakim, is that they could have been giants as well, or hybrids that were listed there. But then you have Canaanites and other ones that are clearly hybrids.
Now, in these nations of giants, are they just giants, or are there normal-sized humans in the same nations?
Before the migration of humans, you have tribes of giants forming into nations. So they were multiple numbers of these as they were initially created. And each of them would have had a patriarch that started that nation, just as Rapha would start the Rephaim. Arba is not listed in the time of the Exodus. But his descendants are, who are Anakim. And so there was a tribe of Anakim giants. There was a tribe of Horim giants. And as Deuteronomy talks about, a tribe of Zamzuzim giants, and a tribe of Emim giants, and a tribe of Avim giants. And those still aren't all of the giants. But what we do have is a list in those particular areas that were giant nations, and that they would have ruled over the humans. And then to survive because of that fertility issue that they had after the flood, they would have had to have start to marry in with humans at a certain point, lest they go extinct.
Well, didn't that kill the woman? I mean, birthing a giant could, not be easy.
Generally it would, and they would sacrifice the mothers in favor of the baby and the continuation of the giant race. And then as you get females born, even though there wouldn't have been a lot, they would have hybrids as females, and they're the ones that are going to be used to start new dynasties after the female giants. It'll be hybrid human-female giants that are going to start continue the dynasties. But if you can create in the initial going enough women hybrids, you have that sort of middle area where they would be big enough to handle the whole reproduction sort of cycle from beginning to end. And so, as I said, the hybrids, they would have been larger initially than later, as even those bloodlines start to get diluted with more. So when you see like the Shazu, as they're described in the execration text of Egypt in the lands of the covenant, they range from 7 to 9 to 10 feet tall. So they're still giant-like and big enough, I think, to be that intermediary part. But yeah, you would have had a lot of human daughters sacrificed to make that survival lineage of the royals.
Wow. So we're talking thousands of giants or more.
Yeah, they were very, very plentiful until they ran into an issue where they weren't producing enough females. And I think that was sort of built into that restriction. So there would be, certainly after Babel, there would be a cycle moving towards, and I don't know how quickly it happens, but there would be a beginning of a cycle to take in certain humans. And in this case, some of the favored ones were Nimrod marrying into the giant race. In Mesopotamia, you have, as we talked about, Eliphaz and Esau in Genesis 36. And that would be going on wherever the people from Babel migrated from. So when the people moved up from the sons of Japheth up into Scythia in Asia Minor, which is a huge hotbed of Indo-Aryans and giants, or Indo-Aryans have about 4 to 5 different groupings with their own original language that doesn't come out of the Table of Nation languages. you have people moving in there. And I think what happens is a lot of the names were actually changed after they had intermarried and started bloodlines. And that patriarch that they had name X, but now he might be named Magog, which is a giant name from before the flood. And giants that were named in the Gyges or the Herculides bloodline from Greece after the flood. They were named after giants before the flood as well. And so I think you get a lot of names that will be named after giants. I think Saul was an antediluvian giant name. I haven't found it in the antediluvian records, but we get a King Saul in the Horim giants that later, King Saul has his name changed to when he becomes king of Israel. He's not a Raphaim, but and it means something a little bit different in Hebrew than it would in Indo-Aryan. But it is a name that is identical to the Horim name. And that's the first sighting we get of it, and this is in Genesis 36. But it had that sort of kingship sort of dimension to it. And Saul was a full head and the neck and part of his shoulders taller than any other Israelite. And so the Israelites wanted to have a king like the other nations that had giant kings to protect the Israelites from all of these giant nations.
So what was the time of the giants, date-wise? How was it, hundreds of years? Was it thousands of years? What was the time of the giants?
Well, they're both before and after the flood. So which dating would you be wanting to go, right from their initial creation before the flood?
Well, I'd like to know when was the last giant nation to fall? How long ago?
That it actually fell?
And yeah.
Okay, I got you. So from a biblical perspective, the last of the giant-dominated nations would have fallen in the time of King Solomon.
Oh, okay.
As we would understand them as giants. Now, kings would still have been taller as the average human thereafter because they have a lot of the bloodlines, but they're the hybrids as you're moving forward. So, you know, you get the Babylonian and Assyrian kings and Persian kings of the Beast Empires. They were all taller than the average human, but they weren't, you know, like 12 feet tall or 11 feet tall or that sort of size. They would have been probably 7 to 8 feet tall, maybe 9 feet tall at the most. But it's important to understand.
Go ahead.
I was going to say what's important to understand is that the royals and the beast empires, all the major empires are the descendants of these Raphaim nations that are listed in the Bible, and who knows whether or not there's other ones that come from, you know, different accountings, because we don't know how many incursions were done within that period after the flood and in how many different locations, or did they migrate. We don't really get that information on the giants. We know a lot of them were pushed out of the Middle East, but that doesn't mean other ones weren't already living in areas where they migrated to.
Well, yeah, the reason I'm asking is that there have been giant bones discovered that have all of the characteristics of a Raphaim, and, you know, with the extra fingers and the extra toes and the double teeth and in one case red hair, and in other cases, you know, you don't know, but so that there is a remembrance of those times, even going back as many thousands of years as it does. And it boggles my mind that the giants are so played down and almost said, no, they never happened, which to me is, you know, at this point, ridiculous. Why would they do that to us? I mean, you know, they have a major religion going on, Christianity does. Why not admit that at one point in time, the giants ruled the earth?
Because it's the royals that control this knowledge, and they don't want us to know all of the knowledge because they would be quite upset people, the humans, would be quite upset to know that they illegally took control over things, and they've been oppressing humans ever since. And, you know, there's an interesting account in Josephus, who wrote the history for the Israelite people after the diaspora and the Roman diaspora of the Jews in 70 AD after he was captured. And I pulled a quote that I have beside me for tonight. And he wrote two really interesting things in terms of the notion of the veracity of these giants. He wrote several things, but I have a couple here noted here. It says, this notion that the fallen angels were in some sense the fathers of the old giants was the constant opinion of antiquity. And then the other thing he said that's important is that he says, for which reason, this was in the time of the Exodus, that these relics were kept. And here's what he said. He said, for the reason they removed their camp to Hebron, that would be Kiriath Arba in the time of the giants, and when they had taken it, they slew all of the inhabitants. There were till then left the race of the giants, whose bodies so large and countenances so entirely different from other men that they were surprising to the sight and terrible to the hearing. And the bones of these men are still shown to this very day, unlike to any credible relations of other men. And that they were kept on display as a reminder to the Israelites down to the time of Josephus, and on display in the time of Josephus and the time of Jesus, this is who we fought against.
Wow. So it's really, you know, the 1800 archaeologists that have sort of drawn the curtain and said, nope, never happened.
Yeah, it's been revisionist history. but it's not that they want to erase it from memory. They just don't want all the information known about it, so they keep it alive in literature and entertainment. And they're going to, you know, they're going to come clean about giants in the end time. They're going to deal with it because they want it known who they are, but on their own timetable, so they control it. You know, there's an interesting link for that I have, if people get a hold of me through my website, that deals with bones that are found, that were found between 1850 and 1950 and reported in newspaper stories. So the link takes people to an Excel spreadsheet and gives some of the details of it. And then in one of the columns of the spreadsheet is a link to the actual newspaper story of these giant bones that were found, where they were found, and what happened to them. And two things are typically that happen, you know, with the discovery of the bones is they would call the local university, who would go do the dig, be absolutely astonished. It would make the newspapers. Then they would call the Smithsonian Society, and then they get shipped to the Smithsonian, and they disappear. The other sort of half of the accountings sort of run the similar story of they call the Smithsonian, they go out, they are astounded, they take them, they go back to the Smithsonian, and then they totally disappear. I mean, it's absolutely amazing the power and control that they have over such things. And the Vatican would have the same type of power and control, and they don't want to deal with the whole preternatural nature of the Bible. They only want to deal with certain aspects of that preternatural nature of the Bible, and Protestantism, for the most part, is the same. But that curve, again, happened after the beginning of the Royal Society, which was a formation of Rosicrucians and Freemasons and the noble elite, and made into a charter in 1662. And they called themselves the last of the sorcerers and the first of the scientists. And they wanted to have control of education and science outside the Roman Church. And so all Western science and education basically pays homage to the Royal Society to even this day. And the fellow Smithson was a Rosicrucian and part of the Royal Society. And when he left his wealth, he left it to a trust that he wanted to be used into the U.S., and he had made it a gift to the U.S., and so it took a while for congressmen and presidents and senators working together to take that dowry and create the Smithsonian Society that reports to its vassal. It's a vassal of the Royal Society. So that's the sort of Western organizational from the British bloodlines perspective, how they control the information. But they also work with bloodlines around the world to control that information as well, just as the Vatican participates in that. And there's so much things that they hide below the Vatican and in the all of those chambers below. It's to be just amazing to get into some of those volumes as to what's hidden on both sides for centuries and centuries.
It does make one wonder when things start to evolve and what has been sort of hidden comes to light out of their control, what is going to happen to the stability of Christianity and all other major religions when people begin to understand that what started as pure has been corrupted and doesn't hold the same spiritual meaning that it did when it was founded?
Yeah, I think that's going to be an interesting threshold for everybody on the earth to cross when they see things that will totally overturn all of their preconceived conceptions. And you're going to say, okay, I guess that makes sense. Or you're going to say, you know what? You're giving us all of this information, but it's probably not all true, and I'm not going to accept it because it seems to be slanted in one direction.
Well, you know, we're dealing with bloodlines that are extreme. We're dealing with nations of giants, and you can't tell me that there weren't historians in those nations. And if it wasn't a giant that was recording it, they probably had some little buddy on a chain that was taking notes. I mean, it seems to me that there has to be more information out there about these nations than just the Bible and the Septuagint.
Oh, yes. There would be accounts all over the world. Now, a lot of the accounts might get destroyed in various wars and things, but there is volumes and volumes of this information that will be out there somewhere just waiting to show how the 10 kings have their divine right to rule over the 10 empires of the end time. Because these are going to be either bloodline inherited empires to reinstate their hegemony that was more visible in the past and is now going to have a tighter control on how things are going to go moving forward. And I think that that information is part of the things that they're going to be bringing out. And, you know, and they're going to bring out things from history, and Christians should be prepared for this, that they're going to have to de-deify Jesus and they're going to discredit Paul. There's been sort of overtones to that, but according to the Gnostics and the polytheists, they believe they have evidence that Jesus did not die on the cross, and that's the single thing that our religion as Christians depends on, that he was crucified and he was resurrected. So if he did not die and was not resurrected, whether or not that information planted down in history is true or not, it's going to be an historical record, and it's designed to de-deify Jesus so that they can bring in the other part of the hegemony, which was the mythical religion, that we would understand the religion of Babel with Nimrod, which is the root Hebrew word for Babylon. and that this is the daughters of religion that were part of the Egyptian hierarchical order. And it's the same mythical religion that was part of Babylon. It was Assyria, of Persia, of all the kings. It's the same order until the time of Jesus, where you have Christianity sort of pushing that back in a number of areas. But, you know, if you look at China, which was never really completely Christianized, before communism virus of social masonry was set on China, it took down a completely polytheist bloodline of dragon kings from called the Sons of Heaven from their seraphim fathers, the dragon creator gods. And you had a bloodline that was in Russia before that virus of social masonry was sent to take down junior offshoot of the Putyanin, the Romanovs, and that bloodline, because it was more pure and they weren't cooperating with the Western bloodlines. So there are these records, and there would have been more, but I'm sure a lot of them have been destroyed, but you can bet there's a lot more that hasn't been shown to us, because this is important to the bloodlines. They would like to have their history written from their particular position in the world and bloodline, so that they're not going to destroy everything.
What's the difference between the nations of giants as to those that have a founder and those who don't?
Well, all the giant nations have a patriarch.
Yeah, okay.
And that's what I get. What were you going to say?
I thought some didn't have a patriarch.
Well, you have nations that are hybrids, the offspring of humans and giants versus humans and gods or angels. And so like the Amorites, they don't have a patriarch that comes from the descendants of Noah. It's not listed. That's why in section 3, I go through the patriarchless nations that are listed and provide the patriarch. And I use that same type of research to get to the patriarch of the original tribe that the Zamzumites might be named after, or the Gerzim, or some of the other names. And so they all have patriarchs, but whether they're listed in the Bible or not, that's a whole different ballgame. So only the names of humans are listed in the Table of Nations, but we get nations that show up that don't have patriarchs in the Bible. So that's one of the ways we can start to identify them. You know, another one might be the Perizzim. Or the Geshurim, or the Makathim, and on and on and on. And I list them all throughout the book, but I do most of the main ones that are listed in Section 3 and give you the history of those people and take them back to the patriarch that started that tribe.
Mm-hmm. So in this fourth episode, all of these tribes that you've got listed, or nations, tribes, do not have a patriarch, is that it? Or they do?
They do not have a patriarch listed in the Table of Nations. And they have a patriarch that we get at through the, starting with the name in Hebrew, and then also looking to see whether or not there is places that are named after them, so patrial named, like a mountain as in Seir, for Seir the Horim, and or cities named after them, because those were standard things that were done as the ruling class, that the cities were named after those nation-founding or tribe-founding giants, and mountains were named after them, like Gabal is another one, and there's a group of giants associated with the Amalekim called the Gebelites, or these are Gebelim. They do not have a patriarch in the Table of Nations, but you can trace them back through methods to arrive at who the patriarch that tribe was eponymously named after. So, yes, they had a patriarch. They're just not listed in the Table of Nations because only the descendants of humans and their from a male patriarchy side are listed in the table of nations.
Gotcha. So now these were all polytheistic, right? They were not monotheistic. They were polytheistic, and they encouraged
right.
that.
Yes.
But they were all polytheistic with different gods and goddesses, so that they didn't all...
Yes and no. Yes and no.
Okay.
So what happens in polytheism is they have a source, religion, and pantheon. And uh-huh. for the major gods in each of the pantheons that are around the world, they're the same gods. They just have different vernacular or local names.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's for the top. But as you understand the hierarchy and the council of the gods ruling over the 70 nations, you're going to have different names, different nations with their own thrones that will have another set of gods that are associated. But you still have the main sort of seven wandering stars, so to speak, that's at the top that rule over the council of the gods. So there are... it's based on a hierarchy and on the nations, but it's the same religion. But at the top of that pantheon is the same god. So, for example, Baal would be the same as Osiris, and or Zeus and or Anki, just to name a few. And those are all offspring gods that ruled after the flood. So you would have different parent gods before the flood that would have that same understanding that people lived all around the world. But the top 12, as they're understood in prehistory, would be the same 12 all around the world. Just as there was 12 gods that are listed in the Chinese zodiac, and 12 representations in the Greek zodiac. That's a constant. So understand it's the same root religion. And for the same, you know, hierarchy at the top of the gods, they just had different names around the earth. But there would be other angels that would be specifically just running specific nations that would may have their names wouldn't have their names duplicated around the world in the same way as the top level gods. Was I clear on that? I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, I get you. so,
but it's the same religion.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So that you have these nations of giants. At the same time, are there angels that are still flitting around, that are still giving messages, that are still a part of what's going on this earth plane?
Yeah, there are. So... And lots of the angels. So not all the ones who rebelled went to the pit prison. Only the ones that crossed a certain threshold. One would include the ones that created giants both before and after the flood. So, you know, El created giants before the flood. And then after the flood, his son Baal, who took over, created the Raphaim giants. So he and Anat would have gone to the pit prison, which is why they allegorize them away as being killed. But you can't kill an immortal. They're just in this prison, and they're not coming back. And El and Ashtaroth had the same thing happen before that. But in that hierarchy of the gods, in that council, Saba is this hierarchy of rulers. Saba is the Hebrew word for an army of angels, have rank and order. You would just have ones move up. So angels that did the same sins as the angels before the flood, they all went to the pit prison, and then they were replaced from others. So we don't know how many of the rebellious angels went to the pit prison. We know not all of them did, and that there are a lot of angels, both loyal and rebellious. So in the book of Revelation, in Daniel 8, you have a number that could be an allegorical number because angels are also counted as the number of the stars throughout the universe, an uncountable number. But the number that they provide, and it's the same number, which is interesting, is 10,000 times 10,000, surround the four sides of God's throne in heaven. That is 100 million. So Revelation 12 tells us that at least by the end time, and I think right from the beginning of the rebellion or shortly thereafter, all of them would rebel at the same time. A third of them rebelled. So if the number is accurate, as opposed to an allegorical number that would be, you know, even bigger than 100 million, you would have at least 33 million angels that rebelled, and not all of them are in the abyss. In the abyss. And even if you had 10% that weren't, which seems like a low percentage, that would still be 3 million. You could also calculate that as 50 million as a third, depending on how you want to get at that number. So there's a lot of angels that aren't in the pit prison that have been ruling this world, who replaced all the ones that went to the pit prison underneath the authority of Satan, who sits above the council of the gods. And they've been guiding the demons and the spurious offspring and the bloodlines through the occult religions ever since. And they're going to make their presence more known as we get closer to the end time. And then, of course, in Revelation 9, you get that pit prison opened up. So they're all coming back.
Terrific. it's going to be interesting.
It's going to be unlike anything we can imagine.
Well, exactly, and that's what I'm thinking here. You know, you're talking. You know, it's one thing to say they're released from the prison, and they come back. Do they come back in physical form? Do they come back in angelic form? How do they come back? I mean, you know, are you going to suddenly see a formation of them flying through the sky, or are they incarnated into a physical form and integrate themselves into the politics of all of the nations? I mean, that could easily be that.
And we don't even know what all of them would look like. And, of course, they have changeling capabilities as well, but... You know, we know certain angels, like seraphim, they have a serpent face. We know the four faces of a cherubim, and they would take one of those faces when they came and took a physical body. It would be a lion head, it would be a bull's head, it would be a human head, or a bird or an eagle's head. And so we know what a cherubim looks like. We know an Ophanim has... one of the faces of a cherubim, and then has similar faces to the for the other three, three of that are included in the cherubim. So we know what a Ophanim might look like, and we have no idea whether or not that fourth one would be wearing four faces, or there's a specific face for a conflated form of a cherubim. But we know about, you know, jackal gods from the Bible and how that might associate with Anubis, but we don't get what Dunamis looked like. And we don't get what Excusia looked like or Arche looked like, and the other angels that are covered off in an earlier section in the book. They would have a different look, and they may not be a human face look. They could be something completely different. There's an interesting passage that's out of Pistis Sophia in chapter 4, and it's a Gnostic gospel. And it's a conversation, according to this Gnostic gospel, of Jesus talking to Mary and talking about, the area where this pit prison is, and it's called the outer darkness. Where a great dragon has a tail in his mouth outside the world and surrounding the whole world, as we would understand as an Ouroboros, and that there are regions of chastisement or punishment within it. And there are 12 mighty angels in there. And just as in Gnosticism, Sophia created the 12 archons. And I won't go through what they all look like, but and they all have specific names that are attached to it. And, you know, one has a crocodile's face, one has a lion's face, one has a dog's face, one has a bull's face, one has a boar's face, one has a bear's face, one has a monkey's face. And you get this idea that we have no idea what some of these other orders look like. So what will they look like when they appear in that sort of form, or will they take some other changeling form? We don't know. What we do know is we get these scorpion creatures that come out of the abyss. And they're going to, with their tails, they're going to cause pain like a scorpion, and people will cry for death, but death will not come. They'll be in torture for 5 months. They're told not to harm the land. And you're not really told biblically who these are. And I do cover them off later in the book, so I don't want to get into who I think they are and how I get there. We'll save that for another show. But you can just imagine all of these different types of beings that we've not been told anything about.
Yeah, it does feel like there's so much more to dig into. It's unbelievable. You do bring up, I mean, we did the elf and the fairy and the dragon, but you also bring up the KKK, which is not representative of what everybody thinks about when you say KKK.
Yeah, when I talk about the ancient KKK, that comes from Genesis 15, and we talked about Genesis 15 on one of the other shows about this book. And in Genesis 15, there are 10 nations that are listed that are occupying the land being promised to Abraham. And this is immediately after the War of Giants, and after Melchizedek has blessed Abraham in Genesis 14. And so God then promises him the land from the Nile to the Euphrates for his descendants. And in that land, there are 10 nations. Many are familiar with the Mighty Seven that are talked about in the Exodus Wars, but this is what I call, you know, the Mighty Ten. And that when we look at the Mighty Ten, that includes three additional nations, which are listed as Kadmonites, which are listed as Kenites and Kenizzites. And none of these three have patriarchs in the Table of Nations. So some people will say, well, you know, Kenaz, you know, the Edomite, or Kenaz, a descendant in the Israelite bloodline, is the patriarch. Well, but these nations show up centuries and centuries before those other ones appear. So they're likely more, you know, named after these individuals that started these tribes. And what's really interesting about the those triple K is that you can get close to who they are in assistance with the Ugaritic texts again, because they have the original Semitic language that Hebrew comes out of it. And so you get these three nations that their names derive out of the Ugaritic texts. And what's interesting is that you have like the Ben Kadim. That's Sun BN, as in Ben, with the E not there, and the Ben Kadmin. That are talked about in the Extrication text. And these are basically meaning in the Ugaritic text, they're basically meaning ancient from the east. And they seem to be associated with the Elam or Olam, ancient from the east, that Nimrod would have intermarried with. So you have these three nations that aren't accounted for that are part of the Mighty Ten that is in the land that is being awarded to Abraham. So if you look at that from sort of a biblical perspective, you get you know, Kenizzite, which comes from Q-N-I-Z-Z-I-Y, Kenizzite. And you get the Kenim or the Kenanites from Keni, and you get the Cadmonim from Q-D-M-I-N. So all of these have that Q letter to it, which was the pronunciation for K. And they're all singular, which is really kind of weird, because if you're talking about them as the ites, as in plural, why do you have a singular name? Typically, when we're looking at these giant eponymously named tribes, they're listed with a singular name. And it struck me that that would be the people, the patriarch that the tribe was eponymously named after. And so, you know, like the Cadmonim, for example, you can take that back to Mount Hermon through other sources than the Ugaritic text. You can connect that to Cadmus of Greek mythology, who was a giant and one of the original giants shortly after the flood, who also begins the Egyptian civilization and took a wife from the Mount Hermon region and was considered also a Greek god. And this is very early. Yeah, this is very early after the flood. They're all talking about the same character. And he produced a race of giants, which would be, you know, thought to be the Cadmonim based on the name. So that's where I start with the ancient KKK. So when we understand KKK and as a secret initiatory society started by Freemasons, and is a tribe based on white supremacy, which is the skin color pale white of the giants, and that they have all of these terms in their organizational structure that goes back to things like dragons and cyclops and Atlantis and things like that. They're putting their allegory right through their structure, and you know, they're basically putting on these white robes to show that they're the supreme white race out of history, as they would reinvent that. And you just the connections are absolutely crazy. So I make some of those connections as I'm talking about these KKK. But what I'm trying to do is establish races of giants for people that are otherwise unaccounted for. They predate a similar name as a patriarch, and they're not listed in the Table of Nations. And they were all throughout the East, and they were all throughout the northern regions of the Covenant Land and just on the other side of the Jordan River. So, yeah, a very, very interesting group of people that seem to be interconnected, and all, like I say, were listed as part of the Detanu, as the assembly of giants in the Ugaritic texts.
With giants, we're looking at a great length of time here. Did they have similar burial techniques than the indigenous peoples? Or, I mean, because, you know, the bones, of course, we're talking back thousands of years, but the bones seem to be hard to find.
Yeah, because as part of their rituals and ceremonies and belief system is that the royals were wanting to make it to the other world where their gods reigned from. So different formats were used, different types of rituals, but all ending up in Sheol or Hades or the other world, or a hundred of different names for that location. And that they wanted to be able to take their body and their bones with them to the other world and their possessions. So they would be either buried with their riches, they would be buried in hidden tombs, they would be buried in sarcophagi. And one deduces you would have similar sort of things with the original, bloodline chiefs in the First Nations, which is separate than the accounting of those giants within the First Nations. They would have been more of a diluted bloodline with the First Nations, but you had migrating giants that showed up sometime later, which are those red-haired giants with elongated skulls that they warred with the First Nations on. So, again, you have to sort of be aware of the two different groups in North America, Central America, and South America.
You know, you look at how many tribes there were, how many groups there were, how many nations there were.
Yeah.
You have to wonder, I mean, are they all, does that bloodline run so true that it can't possibly be a good guy?
Well, I think they have a choice. And so they can choose to be good or not. From a Christian perspective, they'd be a little bit different than the dualistic notion of white hats and black hats, of the micro good versus evil versus the macro between the God of the Bible and the head of the pantheon of polytheism that we call Satan. So in that white hat understanding is they have the interest of humankind at heart better, but from a Christian perspective, they still worship a pagan or pantheon of gods. So it's the same destination as a Christian would look at it, which isn't good. It's just a different route to get there. They're not there to quite remove us from the earth completely right away. But it doesn't mean that giants could not choose to follow the God of the Bible, and we get examples of that. You know, one of the examples is one of the branch tribes of the Horim, which is the singular Huri with a CH. You have to be careful in Hebrew. Sometimes the CH has a K sound, sometimes it has a H sound. So Horim, as it comes out with the H, in the transliteration is C-H-O-R-I-Y. And that's the patriarch as well for the Horim. I am being the male plural. For a demigod nation or for angels. And it's the male plural. So sometimes you get an A-H. So let's say Gibberim, which in the Ugaritic text is used for mighty, also has a tribe of Gibberim in the Ugaritic text as well. But you can also get Gibberah, which is the female version of it, which could reflect a female giant or used as an action of the meaning being used, that mightiness would be used in a certain way. So it's more of an action descriptive in it. So, yeah, so 1368 is Gibor, singular, and then Gibberah is 1369 in the Strong's lexicon for the female plural for it. And you have another group that are the Hurrians that people in from a biblical research basis have thought, you know, were somehow connected to the Horim and were the same ones. Well, the Hebrew word, as you take that back, would be C-H-I-R-I-Y, would be Huri. And again, for Hurrians. So it has a different patriarch for the Hurrians, which were, you know, part of that northern dynastic ruling of kings that were connected to the Mitanni and several different groups of Indo-Aryan giants in that region. And the Hivim is Hivi, C-H-I-V-V-I-Y. And they're not the same tribe. They're a kin tribe. Some people think that there was some errors that were made in the original Hebrew because you have one particular giant that's named in Genesis 36 that is listed as a Hivim and a Horim. And it's not necessarily a mistake because they're part of the same sort of branch. They just have within the three splinter groups of that branch, three specific patriarchs. And Seir would come out of that. He's not listed as one of the main patriarchs. But he's obviously from the Horim patriarchally tribes because he's listed as a Horim. So Hivim were more or less in the central area. And in the Hivim, they also have another people that were associated by the city's name. And these were known as the Gibeonites. that I would list as Gibeonim. So the Gibeon city was one of the more powerful royal cities of the Pentapolis cities, or five city-states. It would be the royal city, and it was considered as strong or stronger than Jericho. And these are the ones that march off to, in disguise, to Joshua to make a treaty with them. And they say they're foreigners, but they're from, you know, one of the more powerful city-states and Pentapolis of the Rephaim hegemony of the post-Diluvian world. And they're filled with mighty ones, as they're described. And so, but Joshua makes a treaty with them. But when he finds out he's been deceived, he doesn't tear up the treaty. He actually honors it, and God backs it. And these Hivim, also called Gibeonites, become temple servants. And they become bloodline temple servants down through history. And they'll be known as the Nephonim, as they're known in the time of Solomon. And then there's a bloodline of them that even come back in the time of the return from Persia. There's some Nephonim in there as well. So they had a choice. And if they're going to be in the temple, they would have converted. Or they were moles, but we have no evidence that they were moles. So they would have converted.
You've got the Hivims, and then you've got the Avims. Just one letter difference. Are they connected, or
yeah,
are they... I mean,
yeah,
it seems to me they've got it.
Yeah, some scholars connect them as the same. My research shows that they're different, and they lived in different cities. And so how they got there as being the same is the Hebrew word for the definite article, as in ha Elohim or ha Satan, as opposed to a God or a Satan. And so they connect ha Avim as being Havim. And I get how they get there, but the cities they lived in and the meanings and the etymology of the words don't really match. And so I break them down into different tribes. So you have the Avim, and they are related to it's Hebrew Avi, A-V-V-I-E, there's no H in there, and no ha associated with it. But they're also related to Avi city, that was also a main city in the Edom area, and another city of similar name, and also with Eva, that was in Mesopotamia, and they all root back in the etymology to the same root, and it means ruins. So it has a completely different meaning, and different cities and locations and where the Hivim were in. The Hivim were more in the central area, and the Avim were more in the west and in the south. And then there's a pocket in the east on the other side of the Jordan River. So I try and make that clear, that I think from my research and the cities that were named after them, there were two distinct races, all considered Rapha or Raphaim as the same kind of post-Diluvian giant, but a different tribe of the giants and different than the three Horim branches, but closely associated in the alliances.
Yeah, I'm wondering, they were tribes, they were nations. Was their only objective to go out and conquer? I mean, because in some place I read that they were all basically focused the way the Sodom and Gomorrah were. You know, they were lustful. They were. You know, there was no redemption there as far as character goes, and yet they had to be warriors. They had to be intentional. They had to have a certain amount of leadership qualities. So, you know, I'm trying to wrap my way around, you know, something that has no redemptive qualities at all, and yet they were nations and they conquered other places and they gathered their power, and it seems to me that there has to be some form of intelligent organization there other than just lust and killing and stuff like that.
Oh, and in their belief system, and studies that would suggest from the Rh negative bloodline, which is a manifestation from the genes, the LB gens or the Julie gens or the LB gens, all the different gens that are around the world, they have a IQ level even to this date that is 135 plus. So they're thought to be gifted with intelligence, maybe not wisdom from a monotheist perspective, but they weren't stupid. Now, they were hubris and narcissistic, you know, just as many of our presidents are, but that doesn't mean they were stupid, right, or are stupid. So we have to sort of look at it that maybe they were akin to Satan, who was, you know, as the devil is understood as diabolos, and diabolical is sourced back to diabolos as the source word for it, and you know, intelligent geniuses, and they were able to control the world not only through their might and force and in time, you know, fewer numbers, and maintain that control. The only rivals they had was with other bloodlines. So when you mention in Sodom and Gomorrah and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, which would have been Rephaim kings, they were protected, the Canaanites, within an alliance. And that's why you have, when the Canaanites broke away from the earth, the third alliance tribute that was imposed on them, that the giant kings from Mesopotamia, and I cover this off in giant terms, and unlike anybody else does in the next section in the Giant Wars, they come and they attack Mount Hermon first, and then they go south and they're knocking off people, giant nations, and down into Edom and Seir. And then at the end of that campaign, they go over to the Canaanites after all of their protection has been taken away. So there was rivals that were always sort of ongoing in that time. And they're all trying to, it's like, I think I might have said this on a past show, it's like the Highlander movies. There can only be one in their sort of understanding. There can only be one dynasty that is destined to rule the world. And they all want to be that bloodline. So within that, they have an agenda to get to where they want to go. And directionally, they're working in that direction. But there is much their own obstacles from getting there through their own, I guess, self-determined glory that they want to be at the top. You know, if they just work together, then they would be able to establish it, but then you wouldn't have one royal family for the whole world, which is where they would like to end up. It's just that there's multiple rivals.
Well, some of these tribes are headed by a giant, and some, or all the ones that you covered in the fourth episode, are they all Raphaim?
Yes.
Yes.
And,
okay.
And initially all pure giant tribes, right? And before the people from Babel would migrate to where they lived.
Okay. Because so I was thinking, you know, if it were all giants, giants are immortal and can't be killed, so going to war is senseless. But with the Raphaim, they can be killed.
Well, yeah, I mean, even the Nephilim had that physical immortality taken away in Genesis 6:3, but they were still hard to kill. And the Raphaim, you know, have, and the Nephilim probably even had better self-healing powers. And so as we described in I think, in the first section of the book in the first show in this series, that Rapha has a series of words associated with it that all describe these giants, and Rapha could heal themselves. And Rapha in Hebrew means to heal, as the source word. And 7496 from 7495, it derives the same word Rapha for the disembodied spirits of the giants. And 7497 derives from 7495 as well for healing. And that's the tribe of giants. And then you have some names that derive in that whole source to, derivative words as being part of the same meaning and understanding. And this is on display in the Ugaritic texts with the Rephiu and the Rephiim. So they were not only dynastic kings and giants and members of the assembly of the Tetanu, which, you know, I don't know whether I mentioned in past shows, is D and the T are kind of interchangeable in a lot of the languages. So you see it show up in Hebrew as Dedan with two D's, not with a T. It is D-I-T-A-N-U. And you've got the word Anu in there as well, which is of heaven. These are the titans of heaven. So in the Greek version, it's with two T's, T-I-T-A-N, and it just doesn't have heaven on the end, because it's understood that there are titans which are gods from heaven and earthly titans, just as the heroes were another name for those earthly titans. So these beings were not immortal after Genesis 6:3. They could be killed. Or there was an age limit on the body unless you applied some sort of technology. So in the Ugaritic text, they were also healers. And that's the way the Ugaritic text likes to define RPM, which is the source word for Rapha or Raphaim. And you can define it as that, but it has the other meanings that I've described, that they're described as in the Ugaritic text. And what this self-healing means is, if you didn't take their head off in a sudden strike or blow, they could repair themselves. Now, some people think that's through the sarcophagus, perhaps, or maybe it was in the DNA that they could self-heal, but you had to take their heads so that they couldn't come back to life. But those bodies would die and did die because God was not going to permit, going forward from the creation of the Nephilim before the flood, after those giants were created, that you would have a physical immortal body in the physical world that housed an immortal spirit. That violated the laws of the creation, as he put it down. So he limited it. He didn't say the spirit wasn't going to be immortal with the counterfeit spirit. He just said that oikaterion, the soul and the body, would go back to dust.
So do they have spirits? The Raphaim and the Nephilim, is there a spirit within, or are they empty?
Oh, no, they have spirits. It's the disembodied spirits. It's the demon spirits. When you look at that, the word that is used for devils, for beings that are possessing people that Jesus is encountering with, it shouldn't be translated as devil. The Greek word is not diablos, as in devil for Satan. It is daemon, the source word for demon. These are the spirits that don't go to sleep and aren't permitted to go to heaven. And so they're going to go either find their way to be with their gods, as in going to Hades or Sheol, or they're going to the pit prison as part of the terrible ones who did the horrible things on earth, and or they're going to be wandering the earth looking for a host body, as in a human, to possess, so they have a place to come to rest. This is the same concept of these demon spirits that are in the Old Testament, that are translated in Deuteronomy 32:17 and Psalms 106:37 as devils as well. And that goes back, and this is who Israelites and others were sacrificing to, because the demigods were thought to be, offspring of the gods and were godlike, and you would do sacrifices to these demon spirits as well. It's like the hero worship that they would do, these these in Greek mythology, after the hero died, he was so upset, his spirit would come back and to haunt the place that he originally ruled. And so that was called hero worship, and they would do rituals and sacrifice to appease this demon spirit. And that word devil in Deuteronomy 32 and Psalms 106 is the Hebrew word shed, S-H-E-D, or sed, and very similar to sede, shay, seed, all the different words for the shay people, or the Tuatha Dé Danann, and shed means a demon spirit, a devil spirit. And then also we have, that's probably enough explanation that there's lots of biblical application for that. These devil spirits are the disembodied spirits of the Raphaim and the Nephilim that didn't go to the pit prison and didn't make it to Hades. And in the encounters that Jesus described, they're described as unclean spirits, and they're described as evil spirits. And devil or daemon, unclean and evil spirits are used interchangeably in those accounts as the same spirit being, but they're not fallen angels. These are the counterfeit spirits that once the body died, there's only those three places to go.
So in the Bible, when they talk of the covenant land, I know the giants settled are we talking the land that God promised Moses, and is that why the giants settled there, just to kind of thumb their noses at God? Or is that not the land we're talking about?
If I understand your question correctly, is the covenant land the land of God, and did the giants settle there for a particular purpose? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I think I said it wrong. The covenant land that is talked of in the Bible, is that where the Canaanites were?
Yes.
Or did the...
Yes.
And so they settled there on purpose.
They did. They moved in because of the curse of Ham that became the curse of Canaan. They did not want to be subservient. And they also supplied the daughters to the Baalim gods, or Canaan did, to supplied some of his daughters to create the original Raphaim. And then after Babel, they went to the covenant land instead of Africa, which was the land designated for the Hamites. And the land where the Canaanites settled it is the covenant land. And that was God's land that he had reserved for himself and bequeathed to Israel later on. And so the giants, following their gods, they would know how the land would be dispersed in the world. And many of the giants moved there out of spite as well. And I think they were waiting there for the nation of Israel, the nation of hope from a monotheist perspective, to come out and would try and wipe them from the face of the earth, so that the whole plan to save humankind would be destroyed, because there would be no inheritors to the blessings. And then it would go over to the Amalekites or the Midianites.
Well,
the Midianites also make a claim through Keturah, the concubine of Abraham.
With all the property available, what was so special about that land?
Well, that land is the same land that Eden was in before the flood. And again, we get told by the descriptions that there's four rivers that are talked about. The two that we can identify is the Euphrates rivers and the Nile river. So the same parcel of land that is promised to Abraham by God in Genesis 15, where the mighty ten had settled. And it included Mount Hermon, an ancient holy mountain that became accursed and took its name from the curse that the watchers took to create the giants originally, and probably re-swore that oath at Mount Hermon as well after the flood. And It is a land that God had reserved for himself from the beginning, and that they were there to defile the land in spite of God and to wait for the nation of hope to come. So we can identify the land that God had reserved for himself. And when we talked about in section one about, or section two about the assembly of the gods, that there were 70 nations and the world was parceled up into those 70 nations and ruled over by the pantheon of the gods in the beginning, and one part was reserved for God. So the rest of the world is divvied up to the 70 nations. That parcel that I just talked about was the land that God held for himself and gifted to Israel when they came about.
It just again I know there aren't any records, so, you know, it may have been divvied out too, but, you know, with an entire world to spread yourself out on, seems to me that one little piece of dirt wouldn't have been that important. So I'm wondering,
even in polytheism, they had the same divvying up of the world. You know, and you had, you know, even before Israel was created and before the flood, with the same 70 nations numbered by the sons of Adam, according to Deuteronomy 32, you would have the same things. And you had war and people wanting to take over things that was going on back then as well, too. So it's just that military warrior aspect of the giants that is always wanting to take more.
Before the giants, was there war?
We're not told of war before the giants created in Genesis 6. We're told, and I cover this off in Book 1, that there was a degradation of the Cainite line into violence and into legalism and a whole bunch of, you know, sort of things that were not how God wanted Adam and his descendants to live. But you didn't get that war capability and application until the creation of the giants and the knowledge that is equated with Azazel in the book of Enoch, that provided all of the knowledge to the art of war and making weaponry. And so that angelic technology was applied to the type of weapons that would have been created. You would have had the ability to manufacture weapons, and you would have had strategy and disciplines like martial arts and all sorts of self-defense training that was taught to the giants with that knowledge, and that was used to bring about the war. And I think with a level of technology that would have destroyed the whole antediluvian world by fire through this technology from the angels. And one of the reasons why God brought about the flood so that wouldn't happen, because that destruction by fire is reserved for the end time. And the other thing is that they were destroying the world. They were corrupting it. We've talked about this in past shows, as in the Hebrew word shakath, which means the whole earth was corrupted. It means perverted, decayed, words like that. And that means that DNA was changed, genomes were changed, and it was all completely changed from its original nature, which is why God called all the animals to the ark that weren't corrupted DNA to restart the world after the flood. So, yeah, I think that was introduced. That war was introduced to the Nephilim by the fallen angels, and then that knowledge was taken forward to the giants after the flood as well.
Yeah, that makes sense, because it wasn't just warring, you know, implements of war. It was also jewelry, and it was also makeup, And it was also, I mean, there were other skills there that really came in very handy. It's just these other ones that they slipped in that you know, I think animal husbandry came in
at
that same time.
And within the body of the knowledge that was provided, I mean, all knowledge can be used for good and for evil. Unfortunately, most applications of knowledge ends up being applied as evil.
That is very true.
So that's the unfortunate part with it, right? But the fallen angels knew what they were doing when they were providing that knowledge. And I think they were doing it at an accelerated rate. So when we look at the days of Noah, you know, the first chapter that I open up the book two with, and that, you know, people think it's just the violence, but they don't understand the extent of the violence and who caused the violence and the godlessness, and they don't understand what caused the godlessness that, you know, was the days of Noah. They don't want to look at the larger context of any of that. Yeah. And yet we're told it's going to be like the days of Noah, or the generation of Noah. And that includes all of the awful things that happened just before the flood and then shortly again after the flood when the fallen angels were walking amongst us and they had created giants both before and after the flood. And that's what's coming again at the peak of the technology that we're just arriving at today to do DNA manipulation, to do angelic technology, to have neural interlinks and hive mentality. Everything that was is going to happen again. And in a way, even from what we can understand about the days of Noah, we can't imagine it because it just, you know, the technology is beyond what we have right now. And the size of these creatures and the ambitions of them is just something, it's just a level that we just can't sort of mentally get past. And even the elect is going to be deceived as they apply all of this knowledge and disinformation to drive us into, as in cattle herding us to a specific destination that will permit the universal religion of Babylon, that will permit the global government of 10 empires with 10 bloodline kings or new Nephilim kings that will make the way for their dragon Messiah for the last 3.5 years.
Isn't there already a building that is being built somewhere? I'm not sure where, but that will be merging Christianity and Muslimism or Hinduism? Isn't there? Yeah.
And Judaism. Yeah, that's in Abu Dhabi. Yeah, it's way past due from being opening, so there's obviously some construction delays. But, yeah, Pope Francis has worked on that with Muslim leaders and with Jewish leaders to create this new city that will be sort of the first step to try and reuniting the three monotheist religions.
Why is not more out there about this? I mean, it makes sense, but why do you not hear anything about it?
It's being done like a black ops, like it's everything secret. Like it should be a lot of attention to it, but maybe they don't want too much attention until it's completely built. But I mean, people have to know in the Middle East that this is being built. And right now, I don't think they've built bridges that can bring the three together. So they must be planning something extraordinary to do this.
Well,
and
they also must be thinking that we better get together while we have the power to do so before we're forced to do so.
Yep. And to me, it's kind of one of those first steps is let's get monotheism back together so that we can bring it back in through Moses as that intersection with all of the three into the mystery religion of the antediluvian age, or the religion of Atlantis, or the daughters of Babel after the flood, bring it back into what they believe is the root religion, and that monotheism was born in polytheism through Moses, who was a polytheist in their belief system, not my belief system, and that monotheism was created by the monarchy to increase their mythos and went rogue from the original polytheism, as the Essenes and the Kabbalists belief.
Well, that's a great place to end. Now everybody's going to be scrambling to see if they can find that temple. it's in Abu Dhabi. I've seen the plans for it. I've seen pictures of it. So I know what it's supposed to look like eventually. In the few minutes we have left, do you want to let people know how they can get a hold of you?
Yes, I do. And the best way to get a hold of me is through my website, thegenesis6conspiracy.com. That's Genesis 6, the number 6, conspiracy.com. And on that website, there is a contact the author section, and you can type in your message to me there, and that will come directly through to me from my email on the website, and that email is genesis6conspiracy@gmail.com. You don't have to write that down to use it, but if you did want to write it down from the show, again, genesis6conspiracy@gmail.com. And I supply all the documents that, if I mentioned any tonight, and I think I did, I supply those at no charge. So if you want to get a hold of me for that, or if you want to ask a question, I'm still running about 2 months behind on answering emails. I'm just under 2 months now, so I'm starting to make some gains on that. So be patient. I will get back to you. I do them in order. And if you want to find a little bit more about my books, I have a generous excerpt of all 98 chapters of Book 1 and all 84 chapters of Book 2 on the website. And just the table of contents, let alone the information I provide, probably ought to get your attention. And if you think it's a book for you, you can go to the Buy Now page, and you can go to Book 1 or Book 2 and buy one of those books. And if you wanted to buy both and get the discount, because I have price points for multiple books starting at 2, and you wanted one of each, I have not been able to get that bundled between the two pages. I guess then we're going to have to get another page up there to do it as a separate buy page. But if you wanted one of each, order 2. Or if you wanted 3 of each, order 6. Send me an email. Tell me the quantities that you want of each. You get the discount, and you can get the split the way that you want and how you want it signed. You can also link over to Amazon.ca from those buy now pages. Oh, and those books will be signed with a little note in the book as well if you buy from me. You can also link over to Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, and BarnesandNoble.com. And so you can also link over to get the digital version from Amazon with Kindle from the Buy Now page. So that's the fastest way. There's other online bookstores. Barnes & Noble is also on the link from the Buy Now page. So support me any way that you like. Buy it from me, or buy it from one of the retailers or another online bookstore. Fine by me. And there will be audio versions out. I don't know whether I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago or last week, but Book 1 is slated, is being worked on right now, should be out on Amazon ACX for the end of June. I expect it's going to take a little bit longer than the estimated, so maybe into July, and then 2 to 3 months after that, Book 2 will be out on Amazon, and I will have links from my on my website over to Amazon ACX for the audio if you want to get the audio version. It will be a long book. The estimated timeline to listen to the complete Book 1 is 60 hours, and Book 2 will be a little bit less, but not a whole bunch.
Well, thank you. And we will see you again Monday night for the 5th episode.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Gary. So glad that you could make it, and I'm glad we could get this done so we didn't lose our rhythm here.
Yeah, and I'll just run through a few different names for people that, in case they're not aware of all the different names before the music comes on. of the different names of the tribes that I haven't mentioned tonight. The Perizzim is another tribe. We mentioned the Amalekim. Zuzim is another one that I didn't mention. Geshurim, Gerzim, and Makathim. You also have the Gebelim that I did mention tonight. You have the Cherethim, Kaphtorim, and Casualhim. And those are the ones that, you know, that I just didn't mention, with all the other names that I did mention that were giant names tonight.
Okay.
And then there's a huge list of giant nations that I explore and take them back to their patriarchs. And it's important information as you go forward, as we get into the next section, because these are all the people that are in section 3 and 4, the hybrids and the giants, that Israel was going to do battle with in the conquest of the covenant land, and then throughout the judges and all the way down to King Solomon.
Okay, well, I'll talk to you Monday night.
Sounds good.
Okay, good night now.